Chapter the 15th, Jarl and Lord. Late in the afternoon we went downstairs to check on the progress of the hall. The filthy straw was gone, and we gazed in wonder at the floor, newly revealed. It was made up of small pieces of stone, coloured red and black, no larger than a man's hand, and set in a rippling pattern that made waves across the floor. We were pleased, and Elfwin looked around the walls and said, "I would have these walls lime-washed, that it might be brighter." Boyinda laughed at this and said we should stay our hands at any further changes save for clearing away filth. But I was glad that Elfwin thought this way, for it showed her spirit and pride, and I felt she would not end as had the first bride of Yearling. We went back up to our chamber and shortly heard steps on the stair below. Our dinner was come, brought by the young woman Sousa from the kitchen yard. We sat down to the meal, welcoming it more for remembering whose hand had made it. As we ate, I said, "It is good, is it not, Elfwin, to have a friend here?" Elfwin smiled at this, and Boyinda said, "A friend in high places is always welcome, and what place be higher than the kitchen?" Evening came. We heard the men fill the hall below. We had had no word nor message, no sign of when Yearling might come, and Elfwin, I knew, did not desire to ask either Sidroc or the smirking Toki. Perhaps he was come now, and even then feasting below. The evening wore on, and we lit more cressets against the dark. The noise and laughter went on below. Elfwin began to pace the length of the room, and I wondered at the difference of her temperament by day and by night. Finally, I begged her to sit with me and play, and I set up the gaming bones and we two played. At length, we resolved to sleep. It was too late. He would never come now. So we undressed and unbraided our hair and did it in a simple plait for sleeping. Boyinda trimmed the cressets, though the noise from below was so loud we knew we could not sleep. Still, we got into our beds and bade each other good night and lay in the darkness listening to the roar of the men beneath. It seemed, if anything, to be growing louder and not quieting with the hours. I strained my ears, but could not make anything out. Boyinda grumbled a complaint in the darkness over the noise and stuffed a pillow over her head. In a few minutes I heard her snore. Elfwin lay silently, but I felt surely with her eyes open. The noise was awful to hear because we did not know their speech or songs, and it was all the louder now that we ourselves were quiet. It was a mix of shouts, laughter, clattering plates, snatches of song and oaths. But more than the racket kept me awake. I seemed to feel a rush of troubling fear from the feather bed on which Elfwin lay so quietly. I sat up in the dark. "Elfwin?" I asked in a hushed voice, and at once she sat up, her eyes so wide that they showed even in the gloom of our unlit chamber. At that moment the racket below rose to a furious pitch, and Boyinda snorted and muttered. Then came great laughter and stamping sounds, and all three of us were now bolt upright. Heavy boots tramped up the wooden steps leading to our room, three or four men at least. I wrenched my eyes from the door to Elfwin's face. It was perfectly white. "No," she said softly, in almost a whisper. "Not now, no." I threw off my coverlet. The men were now outside on the landing. There was no time to try and relight a cresset. I pulled our mantles from the wall pegs, slipped into mine, and threw Elfwin's and Boyinda's to them as they clambered out of their beds. Elfwin stood with a stricken look by her bed, clutching her mantle around her, her long pale fingers digging into the soft wool. Now the men were just outside the door, laughing and pounding on the stout wood. One of the voices called out, "Lady Elfwin, Elfseer's daughter, your lord is here." At this there was much laughter, broken off suddenly by a word from one of the men. All was silent. Eowyn took a step towards me and stopped. I drew a breath and tried to still the racing of my heart as I crossed to the door. I called, "Who is it that comes so late to my Lady Eowyn's chamber?" The silence outside the door was unbearable to me. It did not last long. A deep voice broke it, commanding, "Open to yearling, Jarl and Lord." What little colour that was left in Eowyn's cheeks now fled. But she stood straight and did not waver. She gave the slightest of nods, and I, with trembling fingers, grasped the iron on the door and pulled it open. Torchlight spilled into the dark chamber, nearly blinding me with its brilliance, and I moved back by Eowyn's side. Three men came into the room, and I saw that one was Toki and one was Sidroc. The third amongst them strode into the heart of the narrow chamber. So did we first set eyes on Yearling, Lord of Four Stones. He spoke not, but looked upon us, at the room, and mostly at Eowyn. He was perhaps a little above middle height, but not so tall as Sidroc. His chest and arms were of a man far larger, though, and from his sleeveless leathern tunic the bare brawn of his arms gleamed as if oiled. From his neck hung a single ornament on a chain, and from that first night I never saw him without it. It was a curious design, like a shortened, blunt spearhead hung upside down. The silver from which it was worked shone brightly, and it was covered all over with spirals, like unto our own jewels. What was most striking, though, was his bare arms, for he wore this night no linen tunic under his leathern tunic. Coloured designs in red and blue of intertwining serpents were pricked into his arms, the first of such I had ever seen. His hands were large and gloved in short gloves of dark leather, and he wore leathern wrappings about his legs, as if he had returned from battle or the hunt. His hair was light brown, and like many of the Danish warriors, worn long, past shoulder length and braided in two braids. His eyes were blue and bright and flashed out from a wide brow, and but for a nose which had been badly broken, he might have been a man of high good looks. He had no large scars upon his face and was, like most of the Danes, clean-shaven. He was beyond youth. I thought him to be more than 30 years of age, but not much more. His eyes had stopped moving around the room and rested solely on Eowyn. She met his gaze for a moment, and then her cheeks flushed crimson and she looked at the floor. He continued to stare at her, a look that was nearly a glare. He made no move towards her in welcome, nor did he speak. At last she stepped forward, a small step, and without raising her eyes from the floor, inclined her head in the smallest of bows.
"Ah," he said, as if he had won a small challenge. "I see now. You can move, but can you speak?"
His speech was so heavy with the flat twang of the Danes that it was hard to understand. "Of course I speak," began the lady, and I saw that although her head was still down, she was trembling with anger and not fear. "What would you have me say?" she answered more softly. He looked at her and then at me.
"Some word of welcome, perhaps, for your lord, your husband."
And he grinned and stressed this word so that Toki's voice rang out in laughter. Sidroc smiled as well, but stilled Toki. Eowyn bowed lower, but spoke to the floor, and though her voice was low, in it was much resentment. "Welcome, my lord. I am Eowyn, daughter of Ilse, reeve of Cirencester, of the kingdom of Wessex." Yearling was not amused this time.
"Look at me,"
he ordered, and Eowyn did.
"Now you will be Eowyn, wife to Yearling, Jarl and Lord."
His voice was stern, and he took not his bright eyes from her face. Elfwyn's cheek blanched, and she did not move, but kept her eyes fixed on Yearling. Yet for all her steadiness of gaze, I wondered if she saw him at all, but did not rather look past him as one sight-blinded by a charm. I feared to speak, yet feared the silence more. I could not see Toki well, for it was he who held the torch, but I looked to Sidroc, who still stood in the doorway. He looked back at me, and then spoke in a measured voice.
"The lady is tired, uncle, and we have burst upon her and her friends and frightened them, when you only wished to welcome them and thank them for the preparations they have made to greet you."
Yearling said something to Sidroc in their own tongue, and Sidroc answered, and when Yearling looked at us, he was smiling once again.
"I will see you tomorrow," he said flatly,
and he turned and walked past Toki and Sidroc. We heard his step on the stair before Toki turned to follow him. Sidroc turned last and looked at me as I wrapped my arm around Elfin's waist. I lowered my head, but felt gratitude just the same. When all three had gone, Boyinda went to the door and flung it closed. Elfin stood silent, and then pushed out of my embrace and sunk down on the edge of the bed. Boyinda lit a cresset from the brazier, and the little flame danced wildly around the room. Elfin sat limply with her hands in her lap. I looked at Boyinda, but she was still sputtering in anger. I sat down next to Elfin, and as soon as I tried to speak, she flung herself upon the cushions and pounded them with her fists, weeping tears of rage. She went on until her tears came in little short sobs. Boyinda stood before us, wringing her hands, and then turned on her heel and went to the larder chest and brought back a cup of ale. Elfin looked up for a moment at Boyinda's urging. When she saw the offered cup, she sobbed, "Drink it yourself, or give it me if it be poison." Boyinda shot back, "If it were poison, I would give it to the Dane. But as I would not roast in hell for the likes of him, we had better fortify ourselves." And she took a sip of the ale and handed it to me, and I took a sip too. Elfin raised herself from the bed and wiped her face with her hand. "You are too forward, nurse, and now you drink from my own cup," she said. But she took it from my hand when I offered it and drank.
"Ah," protested Boyinda, "me forward, when you greet a Danish jarl thus."
And she began to laugh her deep, hearty laugh.
"When I saw his face when you answered him, ah, 'twas rich."
Elfin did not smile, but she handed back the cup and pushed the hair out of her eyes. Boyinda made much of little, but there was wisdom in her ways, I could see.
The noise below us had died down, but we would not return to our beds so soon. Boyinda opened the window shutter and let the cold night air flood the room, and then closed the shutter and fed the hungry brazier with many pieces of charcoal. I combed out Aelfwyn's hair and braided it up again, and we fluffed out our cushions and pillows and walked up and down the room. All of these things helped to rid the room of the presence of the Danes and to calm our thoughts.
When at last we slipped into our beds, it was late, and I at least was so tired that I fell quickly into the arms of sleep.